The second case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Drew Rogers. Robert Roll is appearing on behalf of Mr. Rogers, the appellant, and Aaron Hankey, Assistant Attorney General, is appearing on behalf of the appellee, State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes, and then Mr. Roll, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal, and you could proceed with your argument.
May it please this highest court, Chief Justice Jensen, fellow justices, counsel. This case has the potential to change the trajectory of criminal defense. On one hand, affirming the convictions will embolden and empower police misconduct. On the other, reversing the convictions will maintain the status quo as we've always known it, that the Constitution reigns supreme. The convictions in this case center around violation of constitutional rights inalienably guaranteed to everyone in this courtroom, that everyone is entitled to be prosecuted in a manner that comports with traditional principles of fairness. Drew Rogers was sentenced to life without parole. The stakes could not be greater. This appeal centers around three issues: due process violation, the refusal of the trial court to instruct the jury on spoliation, and the denial of the Rule 29A motion for judgment of acquittal. Before we move forward, I want to remind this court, affirming the convictions necessarily relies upon two cases: State versus Oakley and Gesser, and Arizona versus Larry Youngblood. Like Oakley and Larry, Drew Rogers meets every single prong of every single standard articulated therein, sans arguably one. I am not conceding he does not meet that prong, but for purposes of this argument, I understand that is where the court's decision will hinge. Oakley Engesser and Larry Youngblood are both members of the National Registry of Exonerations. There are 3,588 members of that registry of all prosecutions since 1989. And I bring that up simply to be mindful as we move through this analysis of what happens when the intentional bad faith prong is applied too rigidly, or there's a refusal to consider evidence of police misconduct. Now, as it relates to constitutional due process in this case, a good faith versus bad faith analysis is required, of course, and it's required because the evidence destroyed is potentially exculpatory. This court most recently stated in State v. Zephyr exactly what we need to look for. And to me, the most important paragraph that this court needs to zero in resolving this is paragraph 24 of State v. Zephyr, where it states, and I'm going to emphasize, those cases in which the police themselves, by their conduct, not what they said, by their conduct, indicate that the evidence could form a basis for exonerating the defendant. Let's talk about undisputed facts. Undisputed, Drew Rogers is put in jail, held without bond. Undisputed, law enforcement seizes the phone at issue, the phone of Donovan Derrick. undisputed. It is communicated to the police that that phone is material. Undisputed, on February 2nd, this is crucially important. On February 2nd, the phone is returned to law enforcement in Spearfish with a report that unambiguously states, we did not download the information on the phone. 2 days later, the police intentionally violate Drew Rogers' constitutional rights. And let's take that in for a moment and appreciate what that means. They took affirmative steps to violate constitutional rights. And the case law from which that exclusionary principle originates, Spano, 1957, cited in Judge Day's findings and conclusions, states, the conduct is excluded because it is abhorrent to society when the criminal investigation tactics rise to the level of improper behavior.
So how does giving the phone back constitute conduct by the police that would indicate that they believe there's a basis that the evidence would have exonerated the defendant?
I'm glad you asked that question, because when that phone is returned to the police on February 2nd, and there's no download that's occurred, that is exculpatory or potentially exculpatory if the phone puts Donovan Derrick at Drew Rogers' house. This case is over. Their conduct, what they do next, is go and try to obtain a confession so they get a shield to the very exculpatory characteristic that the phone communicates to them at that time. And then they...
Is there any evidence, counsel, connecting the conduct of the police? It's within the same two-week time frame. Connecting the conduct of the police in their decision to have the impermissible interview with your client and the decision not to read the report until June, 4 months later, and then to improperly return the phone. Is there any evidence that those two things are connected at all, other than the temporal sequencing?
Well, I again would direct the court to paragraph 24 of State v. Zephyr. That states expressly, we look to the conduct of law enforcement, not the statements. And the conduct, why did they violate his Sixth Amendment rights? To obtain a confession. What would the confession have done? Served as a shield to the exculpatory value that that report communicated to them at that time.
So the court suppressed that interview, and the phone was inadvertently returned to Mr. Derrick and then destroyed by him. So the question I have is there any connection between those two things other than the temporal sequencing? That's 2 weeks apart that the phone's returned and the improper interview.
There's another link here that I want the court to make sure that is considered when it makes a decision. After the unsuccessful attempt to obtain a conviction, to obtain a confession, Drew Rogers did not confess during that interview. That was unsuccessful. And that's crucial, because after that unsuccessful attempt to get the information, which would have served if they were successful in getting a confession, which they weren't, then it was destroyed. It was destroyed after they unsuccessfully, and this isn't capable of dispute, this is what happened. They did not get a confession, and 2 weeks later, the phone's destroyed. And then it's also worth mentioning, a year and a half later, government forensic scientists issue a report stating Donovan Derrick has gunshot residue on his hands. Scientific corroboration of the only reasonable hypothesis of innocence that Drew Rogers has ever put forward. And what's the response to that? The response to that is, well, we contaminated that evidence. We took that from Drew Rogers, too, because I think we all agree, and certainly the state must, that the presence or absence of gunshot residue on Donovan Derrick's hands is material. And their theory of the prosecution is, you don't get that either. We destroyed it. Of course, there's no record that it was destroyed until after we get the scientific reports explaining, yep, that supports the theory of innocence that needs to go too. And that was the response.
What was the circuit court's view of bad faith, good faith in this case?
Yeah. The trial court found, and this is also really important, the trial court found, and I'm quoting the jury trial transcript here because there's not a written decision, Justice Salter. Rather, the state, through the state's attorney's office, would have a reason to obtain the data off the phone to further their theory that Donovan Derrick was not the alleged murderer. Now, what that actually does is it gives you a blank slate. It's a de novo review, and that analysis is precluded by the standard I have to meet. I have to prove that the evidence was potentially exculpatory, potentially, and that it's incapable of recreation. When I prove those two things, I simultaneously prove that the state had a reason to get the government. And the more potentially exculpatory the evidence destroyed is, the more of a reason the state had a motivation to get it. If that kills bad faith,
So you don't think the court's in the trial court's in a better position to assess good faith or bad faith institutionally than a reviewing court? You think that review is not deferential? We can determine bad faith de novo or good faith or whatever?
With all respect to Judge Day, who I think is a fabulous judge, the record before you, the analysis relied upon, is precluded by the standard I have to meet. And let's put ourselves in, Judge.
Let's break that down. The analysis is precluded by the standard you have to meet. I may have gotten it wrong.
You know, that's exactly what I said, and this is very important too. So please make sure I'm unambiguously clear on this. This is the record made by the trial court, is that there's no bad faith because the state had an equal reason to obtain the information.
Right, for its own prosecution. Not for exoneration.
Right.
Right.
But the standard, Justice Salter, that you have me prove is that I have to prove it was potentially exculpatory evidence, and I have to prove that it's incapable of recreation. When I prove those two things, I also prove the state had an interest to get it. My point is, by proving or meeting the standard, I'm simultaneously, if that reasoning is employed, killing my argument.
If you establish that it's potentially useful and that it's been destroyed, that in and of itself is bad faith?
No. My point is that the court's analysis that the state had an equal interest in obtaining it, that is precluded by the standard you have me meet. Because when I prove the standard, I also prove the state had an incentive to get it. In fact, the more exculpatory the evidence is, potentially, the more of incentive they have to get it. Of course they want to be able to tell the jury, yeah, Mr. Roll's wrong on this because we want to get the information too, so we can't make that argument. And so if that rationale is employed to kill bad faith, Justice Salter, the standard is dead. Constitutional due process, guaranteed access to evidence cannot be met by virtue of what you have me prove to show it. You have a blank slate. And who better to make this kind of decision than the highest court reviewing undisputed facts? Spoliation, of course, goes hand in hand with due process, and the case law talks about both. Now, after Engesser was decided, there has been a host of cases, of course, after that. The state cites State v. I want to make sure I pronounce this right. Is it Bosom, Boyson? The last paragraph of that case, this court expressly cautions the state about its obligation to zealously protect evidence. There is no evidence of bad faith in that case. I suggest to you that the undisputed facts before you are so much more egregious, and that's why this case warrants so much more than an admonishment. You warned them what's going to happen. You warned the government what happens. And in this case, we have destruction of the cell phone, and then we have a prosecution that is premised upon conviction can't be met without their admission of contaminating forensic evidence. So they didn't just steal the phone from Drew Rogers. They also stole the gunshot residue. And then they wielded those as a sword, as some type of arrow to convict him. What was he left with?
Mr. Roll, you need to wrap up your initial argument.
I appreciate it. Undisputed evidence in the record sufficiently shows that the bad faith standard by virtue of government conduct has been met.
Thank you. Ms. Hanke, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. No bad faith was present in this case. In fact, the value of Derek's cell phone is being vastly inflated. There is no evidence that puts Derek at Rogers' home that night other than Rogers' own statements. Further, Derek has an alibi, and that alibi was corroborated by Mr. Reddy. In addition, even if that cell phone had been properly downloaded and the data would have put Derek at Rogers' home, it does not prove that Derek shot Destiny Rogers. In fact, all of the evidence suggests otherwise. From the moment law enforcement arrived at Rogers' home, he lied. And as the investigation progressed, the evidence continued to grow against him, ultimately leading to his conviction for second-degree murder of his wife, Destiny Rogers. When he called 911, Rogers refused to tell the operator what happened. He just said, send an ambulance. He never requested for help from law enforcement, even though he claims Derek shot his wife. When law enforcement arrived at the scene, he told the responding officer, I performed CPR on Destiny. However, there is evidence that that was a lie. Rogers claimed Derek came over to his house that night and the two fought about Derek creeping on Destiny. Derek then pulled out a gun and tried to shoot Rogers, but hit Destiny instead. Rogers changed his story about Derek's location within his house. He said at one point he was kind of by the door, perhaps closer to the living room. Either way, it doesn't matter because the coroner's report showed that the gun was placed against Destiny's arm when the trigger was pulled. Rogers said Derek fled in his Mazda, but security footage from that night doesn't show Derek driving through the most direct route home. Rogers also lied to law enforcement about him and Destiny getting along that day because witnesses saw them fighting.
If the cell phone had been downloaded and had showed that Derek was at the residence at the time of the shooting, do you think that Rogers would have found that helpful to his defense?
It may have been helpful, Your Honor, but it still doesn't negate the state's overwhelming evidence. Derek's DNA and fingerprints were found on the gun. No, excuse me, I misspoke. Rogers' DNA and fingerprints were found on the gun. Rogers' fingerprint was on the shell casing. Derek's DNA and fingerprints were not found.
You're going to whether there was prejudice. Let's stick with the opening premise of your remarks, which was about bad faith. You said there is no bad faith, right. But then you jump right to talking about prejudice. So tell me why there's no bad faith.
So for bad faith,
the police took the phone, gave it to the person without gathering the information from it, and the person turns the phone in at Walmart, and it ends up getting destroyed. It wasn't the police that destroyed it. It was
correct.
It was him. It was the owner of the phone that got it back. But
correct.
The police
but
gave it back without.
It still falls, I think, Your Honor, within that lost or destructed evidence. Regardless, but for bad faith to be present, law enforcement had to have intentionally tried to deprive Rogers of that evidence. There is no evidence whatsoever to suggest this was some grand scheme to keep this information off of the cell phone from Rogers. So there was no bad faith. It was an inadvertent mistake. Was it negligent? I can't argue against that, Your Honor, but it was not bad faith. Negligence does not equal bad faith.
How do we review the determination of no bad faith made by the circuit court? Deferentially, or as Mr. Rule suggests, as a matter of, you know, de novo review without any deference?
I think, Your Honor, we need to give deference to the circuit court's determination. The circuit court certainly was there and was in a much better position to review that evidence.
Counsel, on this question of bad faith, is it your position that prior findings of intentional misconduct or bad faith can never be considered, or that on these facts it wasn't appropriate for the circuit court to consider its findings on the Sixth Amendment violation that happened with reference to the interview when trying to determine whether or not Derek's cell phone was released back to him in bad faith?
I won't say it can never be considered as like a totality of the circumstances, I think is what you're getting at, Justice Kern. But in this situation, it was appropriate to view them as separate instances. Certainly, we have the inappropriate interview. The circuit court reviewed that and suppressed whatever information came out of that conversation. But then that was a separate act from this. And again, there was no evidence in this situation in regards to the cell phone. Law enforcement did anything to intentionally deprive Rogers. In fact, if you look at their behavior, it would suggest otherwise. Law enforcement got the search warrant for the phone. They contacted Derek, and Derek gave him the passcode for the phone. Inadvertently, that passcode was not sent. When the cell phone extraction came back completed, law enforcement obviously did not read that report to realize that the proper extraction had not been completed. Since Derek was no longer a witness at this, or excuse me, he was a witness, but he was no longer a suspect at the time, law enforcement didn't want to deprive him of that phone. Again, there wasn't anything to suggest that this was intentionally done to deprive Rogers of any evidence.
Right. So would you say it would be a great lengths to go to undertake an unsuccessful extraction, believing all the time that it would exonerate the defendant and then give it back, right? So if you're the police officers and you're trying to destroy evidence that exonerated a defendant, why would you even attempt to extract the information?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think if this was intentional and law enforcement didn't want...
Unless that was part of the ruse.
I mean, it's obviously possible, Your Honor, but I think that's one heck of a ruse for law enforcement to concoct in this situation. Certainly, I think there were simpler avenues to go about losing the phone, throwing it out the window. I mean, not even getting a search warrant for the phone. There are certainly, I can't speak for law enforcement, but like I said, I think this would be one heck of a ruse if this was all some elaborate game to deprive Rogers of this cell phone. And I would also like to point out, even if a proper cell phone extraction had been done on Derek's phone, there's no guarantee that, A, there would be location evidence. I believe there was an expert that testified that Rogers' phone was extracted and they did not receive location evidence off of his phone. So there's no guarantee Derek's phone would have given us any location information. And then, secondly, just as much as Derek's location could have put him at Roger's house, it also could have put him at Reddy's house, where both him and Reddy said he was for 2 hours that night, impertinent during the time of the murder.
In fact, well, on that last point, wasn't it Derek that told law enforcement, get my phone, it'll show where I was at?
Yes, Your Honor. As Mr. Roll pointed out, with bad faith, one of those prongs is the evidence is incapable of duplication. And while it was not an exact location, law enforcement was able to determine or conduct a cell site analysis and kind of see where Derek's phone was pinging off of the various cell towers. And that expert testified that with all of his hundreds of investigations he's done and hundreds of cell phones he's viewed, in his opinion, Derek was at Reddy's house at the time of the shooting. Because there was no bad faith, there was no need for the circuit court to give a spoliation instruction. For a spoliation instruction, there must have been one of the prongs to be met is is bad faith. And since bad faith was not met, it would have been inappropriate for the circuit court to instruct on spoliation.
So the police gathered Derek's phone because they thought it might contain evidence related to the crime, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And there's a statute out there, it's 23A3714 says police are supposed to preserve evidence related to criminal activity, and then 15 says they're not supposed to return it unless they give the defendant notice that they're returning it.
Correct, Your Honor.
So how does that factor into our consideration of whether there was bad faith? Because they did return it before the completion of the case. They never gave the defendant notice. They didn't comply with the statute. Tell us how you think that interplays.
Correct, Your Honor. Just because law enforcement did not comply with that statute does not automatically equal bad faith. I think it's certainly something that can be considered in the totality of the scheme of things, but failure to follow the statutes does not automatically equal bad faith. And again, I think that goes more towards negligence in this situation. Law enforcement not picking up the phone and calling the state's attorney saying, hey, can we give Derek his phone back? He really wants his phone back. But again, that's negligence, and negligence does not equal bad faith.
Counsel, can you address Mr. Roll's argument regarding what he described as the destruction of gunshot residue evidence analyzed from Derek's hands?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. Actually, that argument is a little confusing to me because, according to Roger's own statement to law enforcement, Derek was wearing gloves when he shot Destiny, so one wouldn't anticipate there being gunshot powder residue on his hands, period. The gunshot powder residue found on Derek's hands was attributed to the arresting officer wearing his shooting gloves when he placed the handcuffs on Derek. And again, this entire situation and scenario was presented to the jury. Mr. Wohl was able to cross-examine the witnesses and to really flesh out what issues he perceived in this case. And these were all presented to the jury, and it was ultimately up to the jury to determine how much credibility to give this evidence and how much to weigh the witnesses' testimony. And obviously, in this case, the jury found that it was Rogers who did shoot his wife. I believe I stated it before, but again, just as much as Roger's phone could have put, just as much as Derek's phone could have put him at Roger's home, it could have also put him at Reddy's house. And honestly, Reddy already corroborated Derek's statements to law enforcement. Hey, I was with Reddy that night. So the cell phone evidence would just further support Derek and Reddy's statements they made to law enforcement. And it wasn't just their statements. There were also text messages between the two where they were going to be meeting up, and also when Derek returned home. There was also a photograph that put the two of them together. At the end of the day, Derek had an alibi and Rogers didn't. Derek had motive, but Rogers did. Derek's fingerprints and DNA weren't on the shell casing, but Rogers was. Derek's DNA wasn't on the gun, but Rogers was.
Well, and that may go to the question of whether the motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted. But if there's bad faith, it doesn't matter how strong the rest of your case is. You're done, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But there wasn't bad faith. At best, law enforcement was acting negligently with the return of the cell phone and with the gunpowder transfer. It wasn't bad faith. There's no evidence to show that law enforcement intentionally destroyed this evidence or deprived Rogers of the evidence.
Would you have to have bad faith and materiality?
So, with when it comes to, I call it the young blood, so to speak, there's two kind of rules of thought with access to evidence. There's Brady and young blood. With Brady, the court looks at materiality, but with young blood, we focus on bad faith. And again, even if this court were to look at materiality, I don't think it's necessary. That's not the standard. But if we were to, we don't know how material that phone was.
I don't think Mr. Rogers is making a claim of materiality. It's a question of maybe potentially exculpatory and bad faith. Is there even an argument that this is material? I mean, we don't know.
Right, we don't know, Your Honor. We don't know. And again, at best, this evidence puts Derek at Rogers' house. It still does not show that Derek is the one that killed Destiny, and that's where when Roger's argument is, well, this was exculpatory, this would have exonerated me, it wouldn't have. Again, at best, it puts Derek there, but it doesn't put the gun in his hand. If there are no further questions, the state would respectfully request this court to affirm Roger's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rule,
Mr.
You can proceed with rebuttal.
Sorry, Chief. Mr. Rule, so if the police, by virtue of their conduct, treated this phone as evidence that could exonerate the defendant, what evidence is there that would give them that indication? They tried the extraction. It was unsuccessful. Why would it be that the police would regard this phone, which, as it relates to the phone, they're in a better position, it would appear, than your client in terms of knowing what's on it? So what is it about the circumstances of this case that suggests really one way or the other that the police had the advantage of knowing what was on it, even though they weren't successful in extracting anything?
Three words: intentional, bad faith. Why did they intentionally, illegally violate his constitutional rights if that phone did not communicate to them at that time?
Well, I suppose you could ask the same question in every case, including Zephyr, where there was an admitted violation of the 14 rule and the 15 rule in terms of giving notice to the defendant that you're going to give something back. So they gave it back. They didn't give notice. There was a violation. We held in Zephyr. The violation alone doesn't lead reflexively to a finding of a due process violation. So I think, you know, it's not necessarily an ipsa dixit. You need something probably more than that. What is it that suggests that the bad faith here is a component of them knowing, hey, this is probably going to exonerate him. We got to get rid of this.
There's a couple things that I need to point out in order to answer your question. A, the standard does not require that law enforcement knew it was exclusively exonerating. The standard in Zephyr states could form a basis for.
Okay, well, let's change the question. Good point. Let's change the question then. What is there that would give them a basis for believing that it could exonerate him?
That they engaged in conduct that's in violation of Supreme Court jurisprudence literally 2 days later.
But from an evidentiary standpoint, what is it about the phone the presence of the phone, them having seized the phone, give it back, whatever, what they think might be on it. What is there in the record that says, yeah, this could potentially form a basis for exonerating the defendant or giving it back to this witness or this third-party perpetrator alleged?
Drew Rogers inextricably, unambiguously telling them that Donovan Derrick did it, and their understanding and knowledge that a phone includes GPS location information. They ask for them every day in this country, multiple times as we've been in this courtroom here today. They are executing affidavits for search warrants for phones to get that information they know exists.
Let me focus you in a little bit on bad faith, Mr. Roll. The definition we've used, bad faith is used as in these cases involving destroyed evidence or statement, means that the state deliberately destroyed the evidence with the intent to deprive the defense of the information. That is, the evidence was destroyed by or at the direction of the state agent who intended to thwart the defense. So I'll give you, the state destroyed this evidence by giving the phone back. But there's the second part of that, and the state agent intended to thwart the defense. And that's really, I think that's what Justice Salter's question is, what is the evidence that the state intended to thwart Mr. Rogers' defense in this case when they gave that phone? Did it intentionally? I'll give you that. But when they gave that back, what's the evidence of intent? We just infer that? Or is there something we can look at in the record to make that determination?
I don't want to sidestep your question because it's important, but I do want to make certain that I make this known. The case law you are referencing is borrowed from the North Dakota Supreme Court, and they cite State v. Schweitzer in their brief, but they read the next sentence where their citation ends. In fact, I insist I'm going to. We have recognized, this is from State v. Schweitzer, the case they cite, we have recognized if the state systematically disregards its duty to protect evidence in its possession zealously, so that haphazard handling and destruction of evidence is commonplace, less stringent rules.
So do you have evidence that this is systematic or that this is a commonplace situation, or was this a one-time mistake by law enforcement?
Well, there's two mistakes that are premised on their theory of conviction, and then there is the lead detective's testimony who states, quote, I just realized shortly before this trial that I had to follow this rule. The rule being the constitutional obligation to zealously protect evidence. He's been doing this for 25 years. Just realized shortly before the trial. So I would respectfully submit that yes, there's plenty of evidence of that in this case. The instruction that was given was, of course, modeled after State v. Zephyr. The issue with it, why it's improper, is because the trial court instructs the jury whether the destruction of the phone bears on guilt or innocence is up to you. There is absolutely no way that the destruction of that evidence could bear on guilt. It is a indirect shift of the burden of proof. There is no conceivable way that the destruction of that phone could bear on guilt. Mindful of the state's burden, the highest that exists in law. That only bears on innocence, the degree of which is up to the jury.
Thank you.
I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly...
real quick.
I'm imploring you, highest jurists of the state of South Dakota, look into this. It is there. Intentional evidence of bad faith, indisputably, is there. The irony is, Drew Rogers begged the police. Look into this. I'm begging you. He killed my wife. He killed her in front of me. We talked at length about what the police did in response. The obvious difference is you listen. You listen very well. What will the legacy of this case be, and how will it affect justice moving forward? Thank you for this incredible opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Roll. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.